Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Flesh and Blood and Bone podcast. I am filmmaker Kira Gardner, and I am here with my special effects makeup artist dad, Tony Gardner.
And I am Tony Gardner.
And that's Tony Gardner. And today we are talking about the time that my dad created Daft Punk's helmets.
A long, long time ago.
We bring this episode to you in September as the 25th anniversary of the day that Daft Punk turned into robots.
According to them, when the recording studio exploded on September 9th.
At 9:09 in the morning.
1999, they became robots.
They became robots.
And that's 25 years this month.
So felt right to do a Daft Punk episode, especially since we talked about the animatronics from Mom and Dad Save the World last episode, which went into you realizing some things for PAX in Warriors of Virtue, and then that kind of helped inform some decision-making in Daft Punk.
Yeah, so here we are.
And to start us off, let's just take a little bit of a history dive into the start of Daft Punk before they were Daft Punk.
Daft Punk consists of its two French members, Thomas and Guimon. And my apologies for later, I consistently pronounce Thomas' name Thomas with an S for some reason, because that's how I grew up saying it, and I have no clue why. The two originally met way back in high school in 1987, and both had similar tastes both in music and movies. In 1992, they formed a band called Darlin'. But after a negative review from Melody's Maker magazine in 1983, who called their music Daft Punky, Darlin' disbanded. At the time, the French duo had started going to Paris raves and seemingly fell in love with electronic and techno music. They worked from their home studio and put together their first album under the new name Daft Punk. They shared their music to Soma Records, who released their debut EP, The New Wave, in 1994, which became a hit. They then released the infamous single Defunk in 1995, which received smaller attention at the time of its release. Thomas and Guimon then signed with Virgin Records the following year in 1996, and Defunk was included in their album titled Homework that was released in January of 1997. Only a month later came the infamous music video for the song, directed by Spike Jonze. Defunk gained more popularity and sold closer to 30,000 copies in 1997. As Daft Punk began to do small tours and press, their music as well as their fame started to grow. The duo have always talked about putting the music first and weren't in the industry for fame. They started hiding their identities, buying cheap plastic masks, paper bags, or sometimes even pillowcases to hide their faces in interviews or photo shoots. The two later devised a more permanent plan, one involving none other than my dad, and on September 9th of 1999, at 9:09, in the morning, the Daft Punk robots were born to the world.
So now, what year is it? Which I don't even know. The beauty of all this is that my dad, this is like my childhood, is my dad doing these helmets for Daft Punk. I was born in 1997. So they've kind of always been around, much like Chucky in my childhood. But I've actually never sat down to have a conversation with you about any of this. I actually have no idea how any of this started. So we're all going to learn together today because I'm an asshole and never asking my dad how he did something so cool. So how did they even find you, Thomas and Guimon? Like, did they stalk your email at the time? Like, how did they approach
you? No, actually, they were friends with Spike Jonze, and I had met Spike Jonze on a movie called Three Kings. And Spike was an actor doing a favor for David O. Russell, acting in the movie. Spike occasionally acts. So
right.
I met him as an actor, and I didn't realize he was a director. And I had to do his makeup. And we just hit it off, and we would talk a lot. And I did his makeup and wounds and stuff on him. And he kept talking while we were shooting. He's like, yeah, I got to get back to finish editing my movie and blah, blah, blah. And I just kept thinking, oh God, here's another actor that wants to be a director, not realizing it was the other way around. And he was actually in post-production on Being John Malkovich.
Oh my God.
So all of a sudden it was like, oh, hey, he's like really a director. So we became friends, and I worked on some stuff with him. And when Thomas and Guiman were talking with Spike about wanting to create a permanent identity, because they always did stuff in disguise because they always wanted it to be about the music and not be about them. So they would wear like pillowcases or weird Halloween masks or...
It's so funny.
Yeah, just anything that was around. And they're like, well, maybe we should get some like uniformity to this and actually create some different persona along the lines of like Kiss or Phantom of the Paradise or something.
Okay.
And there were some directors that Thomas and Guy worked with in France, Alex and Martine, and the four of them together had actually sketched out a couple of ideas. So Spike's like, your ideas sound pretty crazy, but if there's anybody who can figure it out, I think my friend Tony can figure it out. So he set up a meeting and they came. I think the first time was just Thomas and Guy, and they came out and they brought like some stickers and an album, and they had a CD, and they're like, we want to play you some of our music so you know what we're about. And they're like, have you heard this song? I'm like, nope.
Had you heard any of their music?
Well, they kept playing songs, and eventually I'm like, I think I heard that one in a car commercial.
Oh my God.
But then they played Around the World, and I'm like, oh my God, I love that music video.
So that had already come out by the time they approached
you. Yeah, and Michel Gondry directed that.
That's insane.
Just amazing. And I was like, I love the style. I totally get your visual, what you're trying to do. And technology for what they wanted to do as the robots didn't exist then. Like, Guiman actually legitimately wanted like a curved TV screen so he could play more extremely realistic images on his face. And the technology didn't exist to curve anything. We could use LEDs and do a LED screen and curve that. And LEDs were in their, I don't want to say they're in their infancy, but they were big. They were big and they took up a lot of space, and all the wiring and everything required way back when for a three color changing LED was pretty massive. And we're like, okay, well, let's mess around with the technical stuff and see who we know that we can talk to
create literally the impossible.
Yeah, just help us create something new. And then as far as the designs for the helmets, it's like, all right, well, that's pretty straightforward for us. We can get into that right away.
But it was the light aspect that was really crazy.
There's all the technology inside it, and the fact that a human head also had to fit in it. And they want it to be a giant like bubble head. They wanted it to be really
close.
Tight, and all that stuff had to fit. And they had to see, and they had to breathe, and be able to perform.
Yeah, is it hot in there?
Well,
is it
yeah.
Sweaty? Okay.
It's confined. You're confined, and you know, it's all about movement of air and being able to see and breathe too. I mean, the cool thing is they didn't have to sing.
Right.
So we didn't have to worry about that. But one of the very first ideas was doing something with a vocal changer inside the helmet so that when they spoke, the voice that came out wouldn't be there, so that they wouldn't be recognizable. Because in the beginning, we figured they'd be talking. And then as the process of developing the characters moved along, it was determined that they would only speak through their faces. And Tomas's is always words, and sometimes there's some graphics, but it's all the color changing stuff, and everything was limited more to the sides of his head and around his ears, and that was more in sync to the musicality of things, whereas his screen was designed so that it would read graphics, text.
Yeah.
Whereas Guiman would be silent, and all his graphics, instead of being words or text, would be images.
That's cool.
Like hearts and, you know, stuff like that. I think we did one that said, I love you.
Yes.
So there were a couple different things, but mostly he was all about pictures and images. So it was kind of cool to play those two things off each other. But the design of the character lent itself to that sort of approach, because Tomas's visor is long and horizontal, and Guiman's mask was, from the front, was more of a squarish sort of full frame kind of image.
Now, there is like rumors online of like what the guys were inspired by for their helmets, like movies and things like that. But did they reference anything specifically to you when they came to do the helmets?
Well, the way Tomas was describing his character, was, to me, very, and the image that Alex and Martine had drawn out was very much Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is one of my favorite movies. And in talking to Tomas, it was one of his as well. So we're like, that was kind of our inspiration there. And it was also the helmets from THX 1000 and old George Lucas, I think, student film. It started as a student film at USC, and then he remade it as a feature once he got out of school. But that whole sort of police helmet, Gort helmet sort of vibe. I know there's a lot of people that reference Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes.
But we didn't really talk about that.
Okay.
I think it came up later as like it's one of our favorite movies.
And
it
debunked.
Yeah. It wasn't a reference for the aesthetic style.
Maybe more so of the anonymity.
Yeah. And Kiss was referenced for the same reason.
That's so funny. Kiss is a reference for Daft Punk.
Well, just the idea of being able to go on stage and nobody knows who you are. And at the end of the day, you can take whatever
it is
your character is off, whether it's makeup or a helmet.
It's pretty cool.
And go home, you know, walk out the backstage door and nobody bugs you.
So walk me through the process. They have these designs and then you guys are going through it and they need the lighting. But what, like, just take us through that experience.
First thing for us is, you know, confirming that they want to wear this themselves and what they expect to be able to do in it. Electronic music, you're mostly standing in place. So it felt pretty safe that we could be daring in how we approached it. Audio wouldn't be an issue because we could put ear wigs in so that they could hear. Talking was an issue, but we discussed maybe having a mic in there, and then that was eliminated. But really, it became all about making sure everything that figuring out everything they wanted, and then figuring out how to fit that on a head and make it as small as possible. And knowing it was their heads, the first thing we did is we did head casts of both of them, and we cast their hands because they were going to be wearing gloves. We had a structure to build on, and we knew the parameters of how their eyes lined up to their field of vision and all that, and, you know, just being able to like cover their features and still create the design of the sketch in three dimensions over their head, basically. So once we had their heads cast, we got right into it. We pulled out a lot of water-based clay because you can work with it really fast, and just started messing around on their head, playing with different proportions to the ideas of the visors and stuff like that. A couple of people had done some sketches of some of the directions and pushed a couple things in some parallel directions to show options on paper so that we didn't have to waste time in the clay. There was no real deadline. They wanted to turn it around as efficiently as possible, but we were trying to be really fast with time. I think we were doing Shallow Hal at the same time. So when they walked in to talk robots, there were all these big bodysuits and stuff all over the place. And I think they were probably like, what was Spike thinking? Why did he recommend
this guy?
Yeah. But once we had the clay on it, we actually kind of pulled them in. It's like, you know, they would be explaining it, what they wanted. And it's like, dude, just stick your hands in the clay. Show me what you want. Just push it around. So
there you go.
Yeah. So they got involved in their sculptures too, which was pretty fun. We brought in Tom Hester to work on the hands so that everything was happening at once, so the character was cohesive. And that whole thing with the hands started out as sort of like retro, like ribbed rubber glove, but a form-fitting thing with these robotic plates on the back of the hand that would match the helmet. And over time, the hands have changed more than anything, because when they started, there was this big glove and it was black and it had all this ribbing on it, and then it had these giant plates on the back, and it just was very big and very bulky. Through the years, as the characters have been refined, the plates became smaller and flatter, and the glove became a spandex glove.
Oh.
So that they could actually feel the board and everything else. You know, at one point we actually talked about making it so that there was a hole, there was an opening at the end of every finger that was, you know, stitched and sealed around and looked clean. That would be stitched with black thread, and then we would paint the tips of their fingers black so that they could literally feel what and they were doing.
Touch the board.
So it was all about being able to like function in it more than anything. Like the whole ribbed idea of the gloves was also part of their original hoods. Their neck was a big foam rubber cowl that was ribbed, So you didn't get any sense of human anatomy mm-hmm. in the neck at all. But it obviously adds mass, you know.
And it's probably hot, too, combined with everything.
Yeah, for sure. So the original design had that. And then the original designs, also, they were thinking more in lines of being anime style because they had just done Interstellar.
555.
Yeah, and they wanted to figure the robots out really quickly in one aspect because they wanted to include the robots in Interstellar 555 as cartoons, which means that we didn't have to have it 100% done, but at least, you know, the direction. But at the same time, that the Interstellar 555 aesthetic was influencing what we were doing. We kind of leaned into anime style. So extreme, though, that, like, the original designs for the characters, they had hair.
Oh, whoa.
So
that would come out of the helmet?
It was just on top of the helmet. So it was like a character with a visor and a metal face and metal ears, but the back of the head was hair.
Interesting.
Yeah. But again, you're adding layers on somebody and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So by the time you're making a wig to fit a helmet over a guy's head, the wig is the size of 3 human wigs.
Yeah.
Or 4. So all of a sudden, it's like their heads are getting massive. Tomas's original design also had these chrome, like, shoulder pads with a collar that was sort of like a low priest collar. So, like, open in the front. It would be what you would call a collarless shirt.
Okay.
But it was thick and it was metal. It was chrome finished to match his helmet. We had done Contact and done some camera headgear and stuff on Jodie Foster, and she had to wear like a metal chest piece, and we didn't do it for that. But I remember them having to bolt her in and her talking about the limited range of movement she had once it was on. And we experienced the same thing, even abbreviating it just so that it was on the top of the shoulders. You'd lean forward and the whole thing, because it's one piece,
would move forward.
And then all of a sudden your shoulder pads hitting your head. So it was like, those need to go. So it was really trying to balance out the aesthetics of the designs so that it worked in 3D, but also worked on a human body. If somebody had, like, if they were really tall and skinny and had a long, skinny neck, you could get away with adding more stuff.
Right.
The normal proportion person,
you can't subtract somebody's skin.
Yeah. And you're adding and you're trying to keep everything, like, as small and thin as possible. But you're still adding multiple layers, and it's like, all right, we need to scale back. And it was really all about how much of this stuff do we really need in order to make this work and still create something new. So it was definitely like fine-tuning it as we went.
Yeah.
And then the first time they came out, there was no idea for like a uniform or unity in their clothing.
Oh, like their first public appearance with the masks?
Just the first things they did were photo shoots.
Okay.
And it's like, all right, here's a burgundy leather trench coat. Here's a suit jacket embroidered with the Daft Punk logo all over it.
Yeah.
And it was just trying different things. And it was like fashion shoots. It was different for everything they did. And then they did one in, I think, Tokyo and got a little, you know, more creative with stuff. And then they got into some metallic fabric, sort of like a tracksuit vibe, but with metallic fabrics. And that was kind of cool with their heads. So it's like the more that they did and went out, the more the identity sort of became refined. And Tama, like, we gave him they both also wore gauntlets.
Okay.
And the gauntlets had buttons on them. And they They could push. Like, there were pre-programmed answers that Tama could press one button and his face would read out, thank you, or whatever. And then push another button, it's like, nice to meet you, or whatever. And it would scroll across the front of his face. But then there was a dial. You could change the grouping of those to another set of them. And then there was also a keyboard on the other one where he could literally type in
what he wanted to say.
But again, he had gloves on that made his fingers fat. So it's like, how do we streamline this and how do we refine this to make this work more efficiently? But they both ended up with a lot of pre-programmed stuff so that they could either do like visuals or text at a push of a button to respond to people. And I think the idea of not being 100% accurate in your, not accurate's the wrong word, but not being 100% like nailing the question mm-hmm. with your answer made it a little more interesting and a little more mysterious in a way, which ominous. Made it kind of fun. It's like emojis now. You know, it's like, what do I want to answer with that best fits it? I've got these 16 things to pick from, and that's it. So how do I answer?
Now, if it was programmed to their arms, then does that mean there were wires going up their suits and into their back with the rest of their packs?
There were cables coming off the the gauntlets that went to their back. All of the stuff that they wanted inside their head couldn't fit if their head was in it. So we had to make a backpack, and we used the backpack idea from Warriors of Virtue, which was a very small pack confined to your back that you could put batteries on, with, you know, sliding into a harness and be able to pull those out and change them from the side very easily so that it could keep going and not have to be like plugged in or anything like that. And they were Makita batteries for like power drills.
Power drill batteries powered Daft Punk.
Yeah.
Sponsored by.
There was a sponsorship thing, yeah, that we totally missed out on. Oh, and on their back, we decided to make sort of like a shell that fit over all that, that was chrome to match their helmets.
Like a backpack, matching backpack.
Yeah, and that had, it had big tubes that came out and fed all these wires to the back of their head. So the whole electronic phase in the beginning with all the light show stuff looked great, but you got to give them credit for wearing it and selling it because
uncomfortable
an event.
Yeah, yeah.
To do it. But all the electronics were back there. Every one of those LEDs way back then, Russ Schinkel did a lot of the mechanics. And then we actually brought in a guy from San Francisco whose name escapes me, who was responsible for the design of the Jumbotron screens at sporting events in the arenas up there. Because those were all color-changing screens and
just on a very large scale.
Yeah, and you could program them to do stuff. So it's like, let's bring a guy who knows it. So he came in. Russ built everything. We had a clear visor for Guimon and just holes drilled all the way across it. And every hole had an LED mounted in it. And then out of the back of that, I want to say there were literally hundreds of wires.
Oh, my God.
That came out because every LED had to have three wires.
Jesus.
So all this stuff is like wrapping around his head and going down the back of his head, which is why the back of his helmet ended,
has all those wires on it.
It's why it ended up opened up and you see all the wires.
So the aesthetic of his helmet
was driven partially by what we had to fit in his head.
Oh my gosh, that's interesting because it looks really cool, the open back, but you're just like, I have 50,000 wires, so might as well not try to hide it.
And there needed to be some sort of ventilation too, so that back section opened
up.
Doesn't
get hot.
And once we put everything in around Tamar's head, we realized there was no room
to do that.
To do down the back of his head the way the sculpture existed. So we took the back and we lengthened it. It was two halves. We literally pulled the back and then made a ledge and then brought the front a little more of a lip so that we kept the seam line still in the middle, but we lengthened his head a little more. It originally started out a little more ball-ish.
Oh.
And his head got a little longer so that we could fit everything around his head, which you can't tell from the front. And
now
it's just the design. In design, the mantra is basically form follows function, and you design it based on what it has to do. And in this instance, it's literally the form was dictated by the functions that the face had to do because we had to make space.
It also helps it make the helmet look less human-like because it isn't just the size of an ordinary head.
But it's funny because like some things just happen by happenstance. The angle of the plane of the bottom of Guimon's face opened it up so that there was enough ventilation for air to travel through real easily. And then Tomas's, we had some holes in the bottom underneath.
I see that now.
That were sort of like nose-ish holes.
Yeah.
But they allowed him to be able to look down at what he was doing. And then when he's actually performing, he could see
the board.
More of the board and the countertop. While his face is looking forward his robot face is looking forward, he can easily look down and see what he's doing.
It was like a giant melting pot of what needed to happen for the lights and all those things to work on top of the robot aesthetic.
Yeah, it was really figure it out as you go. And over time, you know, it was like, okay, that worked. What can we do differently? And then they decided to do a sort of a style change down the road. And that eliminated all the hardware, which meant the gauntlets went and the backpack went. And we did some very simple lighting stuff in the head. And eventually that disappeared as well. And then they started wearing the black leather. So it's like there's just been a natural progression over time. But in the beginning, it was really about, okay, here's 90 problems. Let's figure them out and figure out how to make it work. And things changed as we went. But some of the stuff, like, you know, like the hair on the head, like, that lasted till right before the first photo shoot.
No way. Yeah. They had hair for that long?
Yeah, because we would do the fittings. I mean, it wasn't
long. Do you have any photos of this?
I don't think from the front. I think only from the back.
What color was their hair?
Close to their real hair color.
So dark hair.
Darker on the silver robot and browner on the gold. But on the gold, it definitely looked different. You know, you could get away with it more with the visor because it was almost like somebody wearing a faceplate.
When was the first time that they went out and performed as robots? Like, what was, like, that process gearing up? Because you had to be there, I'm sure, to make sure.
No.
No?
They were amazing. I mean, we built everything to travel as, you know, we had roadie cases that were lined and all the helmets fit into these sockets and everything could travel. They could go wherever they wanted to and wear them and not need us. When we first showed Tomas how to do the typing and stuff on his arm pads in order to put text across his head, he's just so freaking smart. Like, by the end of that day, he was writing stuff and doing stuff and programming stuff. And we're just like, oh, okay, we're in good hands.
You go, kid.
Yeah, so he could come up with whatever he wanted to and didn't have to be dependent on us to, like, program new stuff for him. He could actually do it. And he got really into all that, and which is really cool to see.
I know we're going to have other episodes about Daft Punk because there's Electroma that you also did with them, and then several music videos.
Which is a
movie. Yes. Yeah. And then several music videos like Technologic and Prime Time of Your Life, which my sister and I are both in, which we can do an episode on that. But did you go see them in concert the first time?
I did not see them in concert until they came to LA. Yeah,
okay.
And then we went. By that point, they were using the pyramid, obviously.
Yes.
They had some images from, like, Prime Time and stuff like that and some of the color schemes and all that, which was really cool to see how they integrated the videos into their stage shows, but not like in a in-your-face kind of way, just very subtly. And got to go watch the pyramid go up, but it was funny because the pyramid existed because we had done a pyramid for
Technologic,
and we had done a robot DJ sitting on, like, the top of a cutoff pyramid with the rest of the pyramid floating above his head.
I just realized people are probably going to think you're part of the Illuminati. And Daft Punk's part of the Illuminati.
And the whole thing was sort of created for this puppet to sit in way back when. And then all of a sudden it's blown up life size and they're in it. And
yeah.
It fits two people. And then they've done the sides of the pyramid with the same LED technology that was in Guimond's helmet. It was, like, just really cool to watch the progression of the way things were used. It just made it really cool, I thought.
That's crazy. Do you ever look back and be like, yo, we did something literally impossible with the technology at the time? I guess not literally because you did it, but, like,
yeah,
that's crazy.
But, I mean, the whole thing with what we do is figuring out, like, you get thrown some crazy problem, then it's like, how do you solve it? So this was just one more. It just had a lot more layers to it. But it's no different than if you were making it for a character actor to walk around in.
That's fair. Yeah.
To a certain degree.
So they came to the right place, is really.
The tricky thing was, like, when you're filming something, you can shoot for a minute and take it off. And
right.
If you don't like it, you can reshoot it. And then what was happening here was this has to go for 2 or 3 hours.
In a hot-ass
with
concert.
No problems. They have to be able to see and perform and do all their work while wearing it throughout the whole thing. They don't get to step off stage. So it needs to be, everything needs to be really solid.
Is that nerve-wracking?
Yeah, for sure. The only time I think they changed their helmet is there was an encore that they would do. And we made black versions of their helmets, which were vacuum plastic.
Cool.
And they were lined, all the design lines were lined with this EL wire that lights up. And they could be in black against black.
But so, have an outline of their design.
Yeah, and there wouldn't be any like reflection on a gold or silver face that's increasing what you're looking at. It stayed consistent. It went through the jacket and the gloves.
Wow.
And these black helmets. And they'd take the helmet off and change for the encore, and that would be the only breather that they would get.
Wow. Yeah. That's really a lot.
Yeah.
They're like the ultimate creature actors in a way, because creature actors in film, you do have breaks and you do get to like step off for a second, but they had to perform for
like
hours.
Honestly, the best comparison would be like Johnny Knoxville in Bad Grandpa Makeup, where he has to wear it for hours and he can't come out and it has to last.
It has to
be
believable.
Or the show doesn't work.
Yeah.
Which is ironic considering that it was Spike Jonze who did Jackass. Who introduced me to these guys.
That's so crazy. So,
yeah.
He had already directed their music video with the dog character? Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Roman Coppola and a couple other people that Spike knows had directed a series of videos, and they put it together, I think, as a VHS at the time.
Wow.
And the dog one with Spike was Defunk. Was one of those. So
that's
how Spike knew them. And then, you know, when they were trying to figure out, you know, and they're talking to Spike later, we want to try like these robots and figure out how to make that work. Spike's like, oh, I know the guy.
He's like, look, I know this guy from this other movie where we shot a person and made it look real.
Yeah.
And we saw into their intestines. So I got a robot guy for you.
Yeah. And then he shows up and we're just doing big fat bodysuits.
For Shallow Hal.
We had to get to know each other. And then, you know, it was really all about collaborative. And my whole experience with them through the years has always been very collaborative. And it's like you're throwing ideas around. It's sort of like an art studio collective.
That's really cool.
And everybody has their own like area of expertise
that you can draw from.
Yeah. And if you don't know the answers, you call the Jumbotron people in San Francisco and
they
get them to fly down for a couple of weeks and help you out.
So we've talked about the lighting process of this, but 3D printing did not exist in this time period and all those other things. So the plastic of the actual helmet, that is their helmets.
It's fiberglass.
Fiberglass at the time.
So we sculpted everything in water-based clay. And then we had to do silicone molds of the helmet sculptures, which are flexible rubber, basically, so that you could cast a hard copy. And the hard copy was the metallic shell. And then we had to figure out, we had done none of this. So we had to figure all this out. It's like, all right, this is going to be the visor. So that needs to be a piece of clear plastic. So let's make a vacuform buck. I mean, now we do this all the time, but this was the first time
we
learned it. So it's like cast a piece of clear vacuform, and then how can you get that tinted or smoked or chromed?
Yeah.
So that you get what you want. The original design idea for Guiman, the gold one, was that his visor was gold as well, and it matched his helmet. So he was consistently one color
big
head. And then the lights would come through the gold of the visor.
Oh.
And we went to the company in Ohio that did the gold plating for the astronaut helmets.
Oh, okay.
And we sent our visors out to them. They gold plated them. And then with Tomas's visors for the silver robot, the idea was the center was red and it faded to black on the sides. So we found an auto body shop in the boonies out here in L.A., that would do chrome metallized plating, but also they could do spray on top of that.
Oh my God.
And do gradated colors, which was great because at that time, nobody was doing that kind of stuff. We were able to successfully create the visions that these guys wanted. But the first thing we realized once we put them both together, and they had a shoot in Paris, actually, in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Uh-huh.
Every single thing in front of Guy-Man was reflected in that gold face. And it was like all sorts of stuff to make it not kick as much. And then all of a sudden, everybody's like, you know what? This metallic thing isn't so great on the, on the front of this. We need to like dull it down. And dull gold didn't look interesting at all. So it ended up going black, and then it faded to gold around the edges.
Okay.
So that it wasn't just a flat plug-in sort of one color thing. So there was a little bit more character to it. And then once they went to the black phase with the black wardrobe, then the visors went solid black for
black. Wow. So they've had a lot of different stages.
There's so many iterations of this, of these guys. Yeah. Which has been fun.
Yeah, because it's also like once you decide to quote unquote, like go out there and do a thing, you don't have to stick to it. You can keep changing it and altering it how you see fit.
Yeah. And there's fans that have done like the evolution of the helmet.
Yeah.
And they've actually figured it out, like how many different versions we've had. And
oh my gosh.
Same with the gloves and all that. So it's fun to see people really get into it. You know, and then over time, they just got so popular and so big. Anything they did, people were
knew about it,
talking about it, like right away. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the internet and social media started, and it gets really hard to
tweak stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people are really looking at it with a fine tooth comb.
Well, I guess society has sort of become this thing where there's like a intellectual property, and it's a specific look for something, and it's like the fun that we had was this can kind of meander its way down a road and become variations on a theme, and they don't have to be stuck as the same thing. People's expectations are the brand is X, and then you mess with the brand. I mean, people mess with the packaging on Pillsbury
dough
and somebody has a hissy fit, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a different world now, and people's expectations are different.
That's fair.
But I think what was enjoyed before was the fact that they did mess with it. The flip side of that is, I think what people appreciated about Kiss is they were consistently always the same characters and not playing with the aesthetic. I mean, eventually they scrapped their makeup and showed themselves for who they were. But then after a period of time, they went back to
doing the
performing
makeup.
In character. And yeah, I think everybody was happier. So it's just, you never know how people are going to react to stuff.
Now, you had to take casts of the guys. Mm-hmm. And then had to make all the molds for the fiberglass. Do these things still exist?
Yes, some stuff does still exist. Some of the molds actually still do exist.
Oh my gosh!
We made a deal that we would destroy their heads once we didn't need them anymore.
That's
so
fair.
So that nobody could, by accident, photograph the head cast and know what they looked like. Because it was all about their anonymity.
Right.
Whereas the hands, it's like, you know.
It's a hand.
It's just a hand cast.
Now, that's another interesting point, because it's about the anonymity, but we had actually like seen their faces prior because of what they were prior to Daft Punk.
Uh-huh, but the internet wasn't that big when they were starting, so those sorts of images weren't really shared.
At that time. This makes sense now, because when I was younger and we had gone to the concert, somebody had asked, like somebody in middle school ended up knowing who Daft Punk was, and they're like, did you see their face? And I'm like, yeah. And then they're like, oh my God. I didn't understand why that was a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
But this makes sense. I'm just like an internet child. So
yeah, it's a different
it's
era.
Such a different world.
Yeah.
Information does not travel as fast.
I have old files of correspondence from Daft Punk, and it's all printed out emails, and I swear to God, there might be one or two things that were faxed.
Oh my gosh.
On fax paper, which is a whole nother reality of like spooled paper. Like,
never sent a fax in my life.
Like a receipt at a restaurant.
Right.
It rolls out and it's on that thermo paper, and over time it fades.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. But we would take like photos, progress photos, we would tape them all together on a piece of paper, and then we would color Xerox that, and then we would fax that.
Wow.
To them, to show like progress and stuff, because they were back and forth between, you know, Europe and here. So that was the easiest way for us to communicate, besides phone calls.
How long would you say overall till like the very first wearable helmet did it take for trial and error?
I'd have to look it up, but I want to say it was maybe, I really want to say it was like around 4 months.
That's pretty fast.
To figure out stuff.
To do all of that.
Yeah, and that includes like flying people into town and helping them with the, having them help us with screens. And then they did the first shoot, and then there were refinements after that and changing the colors of visors and the way things fit together as well.
And also doing stuff with technology that wasn't really done at the time. Was it rather expensive too?
Yeah, it was more expensive than you would think. I mean, if we were going to do this now, all this stuff is readily available.
There are vortex walls that are LED fucking right. Like tiny dots and giant walls.
Right. And the so wiring is nothing, and the circuitry and the hardware. I mean, to do this now, you could probably wear all of it. So it was definitely a different world, and so much of that stuff was new and so expensive for us to get, and like the people that were specialists. But we learned, you know, we literally learned how to do all of it, from vacuum metallizing and experimenting with true metallizing and realizing how much weight that added and how much inconsistency to fits that created, all the way to vacuum metallizing, which is just electrostatic plating basically on thin plastic. So we ran the whole gamut of the experience. And I think it's funny now because like probably every makeup shop around does stuff like this for a Star Wars spinoff or whatever.
Yeah.
And we don't think twice about it now.
Yeah, that's so true. Because also 3D printing has come into play.
Yeah.
So many advancements in technology that it's like Ratatouille. Anybody can cook. Anybody can kind of figure out how to 3D print.
Yeah.
If you can obviously afford the printer and all that stuff. But there's also help. There's YouTube. You can look at tutorials. Yeah. There's TikTok. There's a lot of resources.
And now the fans post stuff where they're like, watch me make my own Daft Punk helmet.
And yeah.
Some of it's really, really good. Like there's a couple of them where they're super impressive.
How does that make you feel about people like, because it's technically your work.
But it's not my property. It's the band's property.
True. You know? I wonder how they feel then of people doing that.
I think for all of us, we talked about it once, and it's flattering that people enjoy it enough to want to recreate it. I think it's fine with people recreating stuff, but when people start selling stuff, I think then it's a different thing, because for the band, it's
them.
Their identity, basically.
Yeah.
And that's why we never showed their full-size helmets or anything, unless they were on a body, you know, like allowing people to take photos of them or anything, of the helmets. It was not allowed here because that's who they are, and I don't think they want to be represented as a dismembered
head. Dismembered head. It's true. They're very respectful. That's why today I have not dressed up as either of the guys, because I'm not going to pretend to be the M and also do a podcast episode in a helmet. That would be very weird and the sound would be awful. So instead I'm wearing this bandana, this red bandana that they gave you and I've had for like the majority of my life. I've actually really never worn it anywhere until today. Yeah. So that's my repping.
Got their logo on it.
Yes, and the triangle.
Uh-huh. And it's got the helmets. They started doing merchandise on their website for a while, and they were doing ornaments and different things too, which is I thought was pretty cool. And we did a pop-up store at one point. We took all the original helmets and the gauntlets, their costumes and stuff, and they did displays on Melrose. It was only up for, like, I think a weekend.
Wow.
And then it was gone, but did, like, custom neon and all that, glass
That's
cases,
so cool.
And had a bunch of their instruments and all that, but also had merchandise, like, T-shirts and stuff with the Technologic robot's head on it or their logo on a jacket.
Oh my gosh.
And they just had some fun with it and the fans really appreciated it. Then there was the museum exhibit in Paris a few years ago. So there's been some stuff where, you know, they're being asked to do different things, or they were being asked to do different things. The thing in Paris a few years ago was all about electronic music, and they had Kraftwerk and a couple other bands having display showing what they did, and we recreated the robots in the Technologic set, which is a land of pyramids basically, with this robot inside one of them with a screen behind him, and we recreated all that and had the robot on a like an audio animatronic track for like a theme park.
Yeah.
Just doing the same thing over and over to the music for like, you know, 8 hours a day, and then they turn it off at the end of the day.
Pack it up, go home.
Yeah.
Ship it back to the
Yeah.
to the US. Yeah. Well, and now they're Now they're no more.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Yeah, Tamon just did a big thing in Paris, interactive dance exhibit. He's scored a ballet, a couple of films.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
They're not busy.
Yeah, really. Just because they're not Daft Punk, the duo together, yeah, doesn't mean that they're not both individuals still doing their stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I think they said in an interview to have the freedom to do other things than what people expect from Daft Punk is, you know.
That's fair. It's a long time.
A good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
That's really cool. Well, do you have a favorite song or music video?
The stuff that we worked on is great, and I got to direct one of them, but Around the World like speaks to the way my brain works, putting visuals to images. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, I would totally have done the same thing. This is awesome. I totally get what everything stands for and how it's working and how it's moving. And I just, and the song is great too.
Yeah.
So I just, every single thing about that one, I think is just, you know, it's one of those things you hope lives
forever. Like, oh, I think it will.
Yeah.
That's really neat. And like, we've already talked about this for a minute here on this episode, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to revisit Daft Punk as a topic, because obviously, as my dad has talked about this, it's spanned, you know, a decade of working with them, if not more, and other experiences. So we definitely want to come back and revisit, you know, my dad directing a music video, Prime Time of Your Life, and Technologic and Electroma and all these other things. But I hope you guys enjoyed kind of their origin story of their helmets. Did you have anything else to add, Dad?
No, just that I really appreciate working with people that are collaborative and artistic and think outside the box, and to have this opportunity.
Yeah.
With them in particular was fantastic. It was just a great experience.
So cool. If you're watching this, guys, Tomas and Guiman, hello, and we love you. And we'll see you all on another episode of the podcast. And next month we are going to talk about Hocus Pocus, because it is October. Because there's always so much for us to talk about with that movie, because there's so much, break it up into two parts so that we can talk about a lot of things. So we'll see you next month, and thank you for watching and listening.
And thank you for listening and watching.
Ha ha ha.